Hello and welcome to another episode of The Backside of Water, a podcast where we delve into the rich history, awesome stories, and fascinating details behind your favorite Disney attractions. I'm Annie Rugit.
I'm Freddie Martin.
And I'm Alex Stewart, and this is actually a momentous occasion. This marks the first time the three of us are recording our episode from a studio instead of within the vast Toonosphere of Mickey's Toontown.
I have to say that I loved exploring that area so much, but that it's also great to be back in the studio doing this like we used to in the olden days.
Yeah, I'm excited because actually, guys, this is the first time I've ever actually recorded with you guys in studio like this.
I didn't even think about that. I always forget that we've always been boots on the ground with you, Freddie. I mean, I gotta ask, how do you like the space?
Oh, it's not bad. I'd call it amazing, even. I never knew you had such a vast and wonderful Imaginarium deep under your house, Al. Though I am confused. Why is there a bunch of old barrels of root beer lining some of the walls here?
Now, Freddie, I know this may come as a shock, but this place was funded by my family's deep root beer ties. My great-grandfather was even known as the Great Root Beer Baron in many parts of the country. When he struck fizzy, caramely liquid gold back in the day, he used all his wealth to create this place, a space to innovate beverage, packaging, and new product technology. He named this place the Imaginarium, a place where his team of Imaginariums were limited only by their creativity.
Al, I never knew.
Well, it's because I try to keep this under wraps as much as possible. There's been a number of outside interests trying to get a hold of the family recipe, and you can never tell who is friend or foe in the cola world, friends.
Well, fair enough, friend. The secret of the Imaginarium is safe with me, and I suppose all of the listeners of our show, right?
Oh, I trust all of them, especially one of our devoted fans who goes by the screen name Soda_Poacher_88. In fact, he's coming over next week for a personalized, in-depth tour that I'm going to give him.
Al, I don't think that's a great idea.
Why is that?
Don't you worry that he'll... Never mind. Let's talk about this when we're not all in air. I don't want to break your poor innocent spirit in front of tens of listeners.
Al, I've got to say, after looking around this place, your great-grandfather was a visionary.
He really was, Freddie. He and his team of trusty Imaginarians were the first to invent the non-disintegrating coaster. And once my great-grandfather passed, the legacy of innovation has been passed also down from generation to generation of Imaginarians. In fact, last I heard, the team is working on a quantum plane manipulation device that allows the user to manipulate the dimensional aspects of a given object. Personally, I'm still a little bit more impressed by that coaster.
Well, hearing all of this reminds me of another visionary that we all know, a man who looked toward the future, not to seek answers to today's problems, but instead sought to prepare ways to solve tomorrow's problems today. That man was Randy Carlyle, my neighbor with the really cool shop vac. You gotta see it. He's my hero. I'm just kidding. I'm sorry. Walt Disney.
And what an amazingly fitting segue into talking about our first episode in our new series, exploring every atom and molecule of the much-anticipated, often confused, always beloved Tomorrowland.
Ooh, I can't even wait to dive into this amazing land.
Well, what are we waiting for? Let's go!
As we discussed, the story of Tomorrowland is inextricably tied to the era in which it was conceived, as well as the intrinsic nature of who Walt Disney was. But first things first, we need to understand the culture of which Walt Disney was a part of at the time while conceiving of Tomorrowland. Enter the Atomic Age.
The Atomic Age roughly began in the summer of 1945 and ran all the way through the 1950s. This time period was framed by the worldwide fear and obsession with all things atomic, which makes sense considering what was going on at the time. You see, at this time, America was embroiled in the waning days of World War II, which also meant that the race for the atomic bomb was well underway. No one in the world was quite sure who would be able to complete the first behemoth bomb, capable of unthinkable destruction. But For anyone who knows their history, America was the first to make it to production, leading to some truly earth-shaking events.
Now, over the ensuing years, humankind would get a front-row seat to the sheer destructive power of that atomic bomb. This power contained in the bomb itself set off a strange fascination in American culture. This obsession with atomic energy would make its way out of the lab and into art, design, and media. Some speculate that this fascination with all things atomic actually stemmed from a desire to quell that anxiety produced from the new possibility of atomic destruction, you see. They speculate that society sought to make all things atomic more accessible and less terrifying. The structure of the atom itself would influence things like wall clocks and indoor lighting, clothing patterns, and even architecture.
Another explanation for the rise of the atomic age comes with the amazing technological leaps that were made possible after the invention of the atomic bomb. Even the very idea of humans being able to control natural elements like the atom opened up new frontiers in physical science, as well as the minds of science fiction writers. The atomic age was a veritable double-edged sword, because some saw this new harnessing of natural power by humans as a great opportunity, while others began to fear what this could mean for humanity. Scientists would begin exploring amazing innovations in atomic power, while science fiction writers would be the mouthpiece of the masses of Americans terrified by a power they never thought would be possible. Needless to say, the atomic age was one of the most paradoxical, wide-eyed, anxiety-inducing not times for Americans.
It was during this era that Walt Disney would start to piece together ideas for his new theme park concept he was thinking about while working at his animation studio. It's no surprise that much of Walt Disney himself can be found within his work, and Disneyland is no exception. Walt drew on his childhood experiences to create spaces like Main Street USA and Frontierland, while drawing on his modern influences for things like Adventureland and Fantasyland. These lands represent a trait in Walt that is arguably the most popular known trait of his, and that was his love for nostalgia.
Walt was known for being the master of making his audience remember way back when, even making some of his fans pine for days that they didn't even live through. Through films like Old Yeller, the Davy Crockett series, So Dear to My Heart, and Pollyanna, Walt Disney reminded us of what the good old days were like.
When the gas lamp gave way to the electric light and the horse and buggy moved aside for the motor car.
This nostalgia was pouring into audiences off movie screens around the world, and as a byproduct, Walt would become renowned for his nostalgic prowess. But because of Walt's reputation as a nostalgia master, another side of his personality would not be as widely recognized. That of his love for the future and innovation.
And to many hardcore Walt Disney fans, it comes as no surprise that he's widely considered to be one of the 20th century's most iconic futurists. But those who may not know much about Disney may be shocked to learn that Walt was the leading futurist of his day, and to this day is still compared to the likes of Steve Jobs and Elon Musk, while also being considered their forefather of sorts.
We keep throwing around the word futurist, which may be a new word for some listeners, so a definition might be helpful. The Oxford English Dictionary defines a futurist as a person who studies the future and makes predictions about it based on current trends, as well as a person or entity relating to a vision of the future, especially one involving the development of technology. And believe it or not, Walt perfectly fit the bill for these definitions.
That's right. Walt was curious. He was a dreamer. And these traits often lead to one becoming lost in the what-could-bes of life. Walt spent much of his life in this space, dreaming about what could be. This penchant for dreaming wasn't just segmented to one period in his life or one aspect of his character. Walt Disney's very life and career were defined by innovation, forward thinking, and dreaming. And the proof is found throughout his entire body of work. It's the fingerprints he left behind.
From very early in his career, Walt began innovating in the fields that he knew, which was animation. The cutting-edge sound technology of 1928 Steamboat Willie skyrocketed Disney's career and made him a household name. This innovation would be followed up in a few years later when Walt innovated color technology and animation with 1932's Silly Symphony, Flower and Trees. He would develop the multiplane camera in 1937 and disrupt the entire entertainment world the same year by releasing the first widely released feature-length animated film, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Walt would also become known as the forefather of theater stereo sound in 1940's release of Fantasia. This film was meant to showcase some of the greatest pieces of classical music in human history, but the sound systems of the time were primitive and not really worthy in Walt's eyes of delivering a premium music listening experience. So being a man with one eye on the future, like he was, he co-developed a system he called Fantasound. This stereophonic system would immerse audiences from all directions, enveloping them in the rich sounds of the orchestral pieces featured in Fantasia.
But as with all new technology, Fantasound was extremely expensive to adopt. This high cost resulted in only a handful of theaters adopting Fantasound. And then the lack of wide adoption of Fantasound, coupled with the world becoming embroiled in an all-out war against the Axis powers in Europe, led to Fantasia becoming a commercial failure. But, like with all great futurists, this little hiccup, as he saw it, didn't stop Walt from looking toward the future.
Walt's dreams of the future continued on, in many ways stronger than ever before. So when it came time to make the park of his dreams, it only made sense that the park would include an area that was close to his heart and affections, as well as the affections of a society entrenched in the love for all things futuristic.
Now, it's good to remember that Walt's Mickey Mouse Park was beginning to cost more and more as Walt's vision for it grew. The original budget was smashed to pieces as the park inched closer and closer to opening. This budget crisis forced Walt to make some last-minute decisions that would ultimately affect the entirety of the park. But no land was affected by this budget constraint more than Tomorrowland.
In Walt's mind, Tomorrowland was going to be a look into the future and how humans would live in the days ahead. Walt and his team decided on a very futuristic date to set his new land in, and that was the year in the far distant future of 1986.
Wait, 1986?
That's right.
Okay, that's not far in the future at all, you guys.
It really isn't. That's actually the year my wife was born, so it was a good year to choose, in my opinion. In fact, originally there were plans for an Ashley Stewart's first year attraction, but it was scrapped due to technological advances needed to tell her story properly.
Oh, gee. What a bunch of baloney.
Guys, seriously, look it up in the scrapped attractions lists all across the internets, and you'll find an attraction titled Ashley's 1986 Adventure.
The beauty
look
of
it
a
up.
Smartphone.
Look it up.
I'm looking it up right now, pal.
Don't. I mean, don't look it up because you can just know I can be trusted.
Al, did you just give me a Jedi mind wave while saying that?
No, Freddy. You're just seeing things. Just seeing things.
Okay. Al, don't you know I have Toydarian blood running through these veins? So those mind tricks do nothing to me. And as I'm searching the web right now, I'm finding literally zero results about an Ashley's 1986 adventure attraction.
Okay. I made the whole thing up.
Shocking.
But hear me out. I bet you can imagine how cool a ride like that would be, huh? I can see it now. The whole thing is shot on a shoulder-mounted VHS camcorder. Little Ashley takes her first steps on floors created using the newest linoleum technology, all while drinking out of a bottle using a newly patented non-spill design.
Wow, that sounds like a truly grand vision of the future by a man head over heels in love. Okay, all right, anyway, listen. Walt's vision of Tomorrowland's 1986, sans Ashley's 1986 adventure, spared no expense and would showcase the best of the best from Wed's team of Imagineers. But like Annie said, this vision was met with the reality that funds to build this walkthrough of the future would have to be realized on a much cheaper and less dazzling scale. Walt wasn't pleased with this kind of compromise, but he didn't have much of a choice. The money had simply run out by the time Tomorrowland's construction began.
On the morning of July 17th, 1955, the first guests would walk into a nearly barren, sometimes soggy Tomorrowland.
Soggy?
Hey, that's right, soggy. Like Freddy mentioned earlier, Tomorrowland was one of the last lands to be built, and since Disneyland was built in a calendar year, the timing of building this park was insanely tight. As a result, Tomorrowland was only presentable on opening day, not completed. This work-in-progress status meant that the concrete in some of the areas of Tomorrowland had been poured days, if not hours, before the park opened.
Yeah, one of my favorite stories about Tomorrowland actually focuses on this concrete issue. It's said that a few women's high heels were pulled from their feet while walking through Tomorrowland due to their heels getting stuck in the wet cement. And you can still see those heel prints in your imagination.
I got excited. I thought, oh, I want to see that someday. But I get it now. It was soggy. Soggy cement. Well, that's pretty cool. So when you say Tomorrowland was fresh, it was very fresh.
Fresh, dope, and fat, Annie. But that okay. freshness didn't stop it from wowing folks as they entered into that part of the park. When guests walked through the entrance of Tomorrowland, they would gaze upon the gargantuan model of a red-tipped TWA-sponsored Moonliner rocket ship. This was the park's tallest structure and served as the land's weenie.
Weenie?
Yes, Annie. Walt referred to the main focal point that draws a guest into a given area of the park as that area's weenie. Just like a dog is drawn toward a hot dog or weenie, guests would be drawn to that object or focal point. And this TWA rocket was the perfect weenie.
I could use a hot dog right now myself. I mean, listen, we have to remember that it wouldn't be another 14 years until Neil Armstrong would walk on the moon in 1969. So space travel and technology was still considered science fiction at this point, far in the future. This is why it would make sense that this giant rocket would be such a drawing point for guests of the 1950s.
No doubt, Freddy.
So once the rocket weenie drew people into its orbit, what would guests encounter?
Well, mostly an empty land.
Really?
Sadly, yes. Since we talked about earlier, money had ran out, Tomorrowland had really only one attraction on opening day, the attraction now known as Autopia.
Why was Tomorrowland such an empty land on opening day?
That's actually a great question, and it's got a really interesting story behind it. This story centers on a guy by the name of C.V. Wood. C.V. Wood, who we have referenced on other episodes of the show, was Walt's right-hand man during the construction of Disneyland. Wood actually convinced Walt that he needed to take his focus away from Tomorrowland and place it on all the other parts of the park. The reason he did this is because, believe it or not, Tomorrowland was not originally slated to be open on opening day. It was intended to be rolled out a few months after the park's opening. But Walt didn't want guests walking into a park and seeing a walled-off area, especially after selling all of the lands of the park on national TV for an entire year. That looked bad in his opinion. The problem was, Walt only decided to open Tomorrowland on opening day very shortly before July 17th. This gave crews only a matter of days to make that area of the park show-ready. As a result of this rush, Tomorrowland would only be show-ready, not necessarily ride-ready, on opening day.
Thankfully, though, Autopia was ready for opening day, and it did not disappoint. But it was hard for guests to be truly wowed by Tomorrowland due to the feeling that it was unfinished, which it really was. But Tomorrowland wouldn't remain unfinished, and that's the big point. In fact, Tomorrowland would go on to house more attractions than any other land in the park. Sadly, most of them are now extinct, many of them for good reason.
Ooh, I love exploring extinct Disneyland attractions.
Well then, Annie, the Imagineering's latest creation might be right up your alley.
Yeah?
Totally. Oh, wait, come to think of it, let me make a call over to the manager of the Hofta Project right now.
Hofta Project?
Okay, hold on.
This is Barnicus.
Hey, Barnicus.
Ah, hey, Alex. So glad to hear from you. I was wondering if your ears were burning. I was just talking to the crew about how we needed to contact you to perform a ride-through of Hofta to get your feedback during test and adjust period.
Oh, then this is perfect timing indeed then, Barnicus. My two co-hosts here are in the studio with me, and I think it would be the perfect time to take that ride. They may even have some insights about items that need to be tweaked before the final authorization for launch goes through.
Ha, brilliant. I'll send the holomover over immediately.
Oh, just arrived. Hey, thanks, Barnicus.
Al, I think I speak for Annie and myself when I say we're deeply confused about what's going on right now.
Oh, you'll get your answers all in due time. In the meantime, let's not keep the holomover waiting.
I'm always game for a good holomover trip.
Wait, what's a holomover? Oh, let me guess. I'll get my answer in due time.
Bingo. Now, let's get going.
Wow, that holomover really cooks. How does it manage to pass us through solid walls and surfaces like that?
Well, Freddy, it's a really complicated process that involves bending the fabric of our known dimensions and allows matter to become more pliable and less resistant to the traditional laws of physics.
You lost me, pal.
Okay, so essentially it allows us to make pathways in matter without disturbing the physical makeup of said matter.
Oh, that makes sense.
Okay, well, anyway, we're here. Hey, Alex! Barnicus! Great to see ya. These are my co-hosts of the show, Annie and Freddy. Delighted to make your acquaintance, you two. Alex has told me much about your adventures, and if you're anything like him, well, I think you're gonna enjoy our latest creation. It's called the Hall of Forgotten Tomorrowland Attractions.
Ooh, sounds amazing.
Oh, it truly is. And if you follow me this way, I'll get the program up and running for all of you to get a sneak peek before we get the final arrangements to send it off to the Smithsonian.
Count me in.
Me too.
Perfect. Right this way. All right, friends. Have a seat wherever you'd like.
Al, this is a beautiful little theater area.
Spared no expense, Andrea.
Hey, let's head down to the front row. That's where we'll get the best view, right, Al?
Ah, perfect. Now, before we begin, please watch your arms as the lap bars are lowered.
Lap bars? Al, what kind of video is this?
Just go with it, Freddy. Now, sit back, relax, and enjoy the Hofta experience.
Hello, and welcome to the Hall of Forgotten Tomorrowland Attractions, presented by the Stewart Beverage Corporation, in partnership with the BSOW Historical Preservation Society. Before the show begins, please remember that there is no eating or drinking while in the Omni Theater. Also, be sure to secure all loose articles in the storage pockets in front of you. Now, sit back and enjoy your journey through the Hall of Forgotten Tomorrowland Attractions.
Hello, I'm Hal Holliday, President and Chairman of the BSOW Historical Preservation Society. And over the next few minutes, I want to take you through a journey that starts back in the summer of 1955.
Ooh, the curtain is rising.
Al, is that a scale model of the original park?
No, it sure is. Spared no expense.
Disneyland opened on July 17th, 1955. But what the park guests saw in 1955 was far from the park we see today. Tomorrowland in particular looked vastly different from how it looks in modern day. As you can see, the land was quite barren. But it wouldn't look that way for long. Join me as we take a closer look at the attractions that would appear in Tomorrowland over its first years.
Oh, look! The park model is moving off stage.
Al, is this a circle theater? Like the Carousel of Progress?
Oh, yes, it is. We thought it would be a nice touch to throw back to such a classic attraction like that.
Wow, a nice touch indeed.
Our first stop on our journey is here aboard the Nautilus from Disney's 1954 hit live-action film, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. What you're seeing before you is an original set piece from the film itself. This set piece would be viewed by guests as they walked through the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea exhibit that would open in late 1955 and run through 1966. Throughout this walkthrough, guests would see miniatures, other set pieces, and memorabilia used during the filming of 20,000 Leagues. This exhibit was installed due to budget shortages Disney and his WED crew encountered during the early days of Disneyland. The thinking behind its installation was that it would be a cheap way to entertain guests while Tomorrowland's main attractions were being built.
Al, this is amazing. It feels like we're really at the park in 1955.
These Imagineerians really are geniuses.
Oh, the scene is changing. Wait a second. The whole theater is changing. Look at all these screens around us.
We now move into the Circarama USA Theater. Installed in late 1955, the Circarama USA Theater would feature short films filmed in 360 degrees. The first installation would be a Tour of the West and would run till 1959. What you're seeing on the screens right now is excerpts from A Tour of the West.
Al, I have to say, I am truly blown away. This attraction is simply breathtaking.
I also have to say, I'm just as stoked. I haven't gotten a chance to ride through this thing entirely yet, so all of this is new to me, too.
Circarama USA would later be named CircleVision 360 and run until 1997. CircleVision 360 would eventually go on to be replaced by Buzz Lightyear Astro Blasters after the closing of the ill-fated Rocket Rods, which opened in 1998.
We're moving again.
Oh, look at that clock. That might be the most magnificent timepiece I've ever seen.
What you see before you is the original Tomorrowland Clock of the World. This shining beacon sat at the entrance of Tomorrowland and displayed the given time of any location in the world. This iconic piece of atomic and mid-century design was the crown jewel of early Tomorrowland. An advertising piece in the Los Angeles Times described this clock this way: 1955 becomes 1986 as you enter the new era. Tomorrowland, where our hopes and dreams for the future become today's realities. Symbolizing the time transition is Tomorrowland's futuristic clock. At a glance, this elaborate chronometer tells you the exact minute and hour anywhere on the face of the planet Earth. This piece of Disney history would welcome guests to the land of the future until 1966, when it would be removed to pave the way for a massive overhaul to Tomorrowland that would take place the following year. Imagineers removed the clock due to the belief that the clock seemed outdated to the guests coming to the parks in the mid-1960s.
That really is a shame. It's an amazing piece of not just Disney history, but art history as well. The mid-century design of the piece was truly amazing to gaze upon.
It really is amazing to see a cool clock like that. I honestly never thought I could be as enraptured by, of all things, a clock, but I love it.
But just as time waits for no person, it is time for us to move on to the next forgotten attraction of Tomorrowland, the Monsanto Hall of Chemistry.
Guys, take a look at those test tubes.
In this Hall of Chemistry, the Monsanto Company would showcase the romance of chemistry and share about all the technological advances being made by the company today to help people of tomorrow. Here before you lies the Chemotron, a grouping of test tubes containing what Monsanto described as the 8 most important elements in nature. The company would boast that from these 8 common substances come almost 500 different Monsanto chemicals and plastics. They would also state that you'll see how these elements promise to build a new and easier way of life for you, your children, and generations to come.
I have to say, as cool as this exhibit seems like it would be, I'm kind of exhausted by how much it says Monsanto everywhere.
Good observation, Annie. We talked earlier about how Walt's park coffers were empty by the time the park opened. Because of this lack of funding, Walt needed to help from outside companies to get attractions into Tomorrowland, and partnering with corporations seemed like the best way to do that. But with these partnerships comes heavy corporate messaging, like you're seeing right here in this exhibit. Which, by the way, Al, well done to the Imagineerians for not trying to revise this corporate saturation piece of the park's history.
Ah, they do their best to preserve things in their original state and allow audiences to draw their own conclusions.
That's a great idea.
We're now going to take a trip out of this world.
Al, is this part of the ride?
I don't think so, Freddy. Something's not right here.
What do we do?
The only thing we can do, Annie. Brace yourselves!
Strange things are indeed afoot in the Hall of Forgotten Tomorrowland attractions. Is the backside of Watercrew all right? Is the world of tomorrow safe? Or has something catastrophic happened? Find out next time on The Backside of Water, a podcast that delves into the rich history, awesome stories, and fascinating details behind your favorite Disney attractions.